Rock Central Friday. We are in the Mobile Kintec studio yet again as we are live from Rogers Arena as we get ready for the Canucks and game number 2 of 82 with an 0-0-1 record in the standings to start for your Canucks. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? Yeah, dress rehearsal will be getting going here at Rogers Arena in just a few moments, and that's what you will hear in the background. But tonight, the Canucks look to bounce back against a team that had their number last year, Sat.
Yeah, the Flyers, and early on in the season, the Canucks had such a bad performance against the Flyers on the road. The coach laid into them and talked about how unacceptable that type of effort was, or lack thereof.
Even, I don't like to use the word soft, but I recall some of the quotes from that now infamous Rick Tocchet newser after the game.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not expecting the same thing. Let's just put it that way.
Matvei Michkov will make his NHL debut, so there is lots to watch on the other side. Flyers playing their first game of the season. We'll get more into that once the pregame show begins, but let's dive into it. It's Canucks Central. It's the Open.
Welcome to the Open.
Oh! That's your home! Are you too good for your home? Answer me!
Yes, the Open here on Canucks Central, where we bring you the latest on the Vancouver Canucks and our take on it. And tonight, the big story is, and has been all day in the lead-up, you saw the pictures last night as the Canucks showed Alex Edler signing his one-day contract with Patrick Alvin in the room. So Patrick Alvin signing one more Swede, just added to the tally here, Sat.
Yeah, you know, not enough Swedes. And maybe one of many future Swedes that are going to join the team on the back end, perhaps.
We'll get into that. Sat's doing a little bit of foreshadowing to what we'll get to in Canucks Central Roundup. But Edler's retiring today, and as of today, he is and will retire as the best defenseman in franchise history, though the most talented defenseman in franchise history will be on the ice and playing for the Vancouver Canucks. It is interesting how this is playing out, but for so many years, for the entirety of the franchise, the Canucks have had a lot of good defensemen. They've had some guys that are real hometown heroes. Edler became one of them, a homegrown talent that you drafted in the later rounds that really develops into a top-end guy. Right, and he evolves over the course of his career. Everything you want to see out of a homegrown player, you saw it in Alex Edler, and now you're seeing it in a different way with a hotshot young prospect, and now the best defenseman in the league, according to the Norris Trophy, Quinn Hughes.
And Hughes, I think, has really put every other Canucks defenseman into real perspective. And I loved watching Alex Edler. We'll talk a bit more about him, obviously, a bit later in the show and a bit later on here. But when you watch Quinn Hughes do the things he does, control the game the way he does, you see such an incredible level difference between what a bona fide Hall of Fame talent looks like versus one of the best defensemen this franchise have had. And we know how good Edler was, and we know how important he was. And his peak, he was incredible for this team. And he deserves all the appreciation he's going to get. An amazing story for the franchise. But you had never seen a true Hall of Fame level type of defenseman until Quinn Hughes arrived. And really, until he showed the level he was at last season. And when you see what Quinn can do, like, he went from not only just being one of the best defensemen, we're talking about one of a handful of players that can control the game the way Quinn can.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a 10 of them in the league if you want to stretch it out, right, and not make it so narrow.
For as many, when you look at top 10 lists of best players in the league, it generally has forwards up there because forwards are the guys doing the goal scoring. They're putting up the points. They are front and center. You see their impact all the time. And while, you know, we've had defensemen like that, and there's always a couple of defensemen that are in the top 10 players in the league at any given moment in NHL history, the thought of that player being with the Vancouver Canucks just never really materialized before Quinn Hughes showed up. And now, going into this season, every, like, top 10, top 100, top 50 player list you saw of NHL players, I don't think I saw one where Quinn Hughes was outside of the top 10, and for good reason. He won the Norris and was, I mean, he got Hart Trophy votes last year, obviously, because of how good, how impactful he was. Like, he was everything to this Canucks team last year.
Yeah, I mean, he truly was. And as far as expectations, when sometimes fans are too hard on players, like Edler at times back in the day was like, well, he's not a true number one defenseman. He needs to be better. It's like, well, you can't ask somebody to be something he's not. What you're asking is something that is special. You see what special is now.
I mean, how many true number one defensemen are actually in the league at any given time?
Yeah, I mean, I think now that list is a bit longer.
Yeah.
But we're talking about a dozen guys.
Yeah. But it's not like you go through, even through the majority of Edler's career where there was 30 teams. Like, you wouldn't go through all 30 teams and be like, hey, every team's got a number one legit D-man. No, that's just not how it works.
There's never been, you know, 30 or even 25, you know, or however many teams there were in the league. There were never the requisite amount of number one, true number one defensemen in the league. They're always hard to get, right? But I think you see the level difference it makes, and that's why you talk about how important it is to find a franchise defenseman. Like, those are the cornerstones you need to truly win a Stanley Cup.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what's exciting about this core here, the group of players they have. Now, are they the finished product that's going to win the Stanley Cup this year? Perhaps not, and there may be more work that needs to be done, but this is the caliber of defenseman you need. And look at the teams that have won. Not every team has a Quinn Hughes caliber player, but most Stanley Cup champions have a true number one defenseman on their blue line.
Yeah. I mean, really, the only one in the Cap era was the Pittsburgh Penguins, led by Jim Rutherford, that didn't have a true number one defenseman. And it was mainly because Letang was hurt. But, you know, Justin Schultz was the guy that was leading the way for them that year, that first cup that they won.
What about even the Panthers last year?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Forsling was their best defenseman, right?
Forsling, you would sort of categorize him.
Did he take
I think
that
now
step?
He's categorized as a number one.
Is he categorized? Yeah, as that. Yeah, perhaps. Right, but and even him, he's somebody that maybe on that borderline.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, there are very few teams that you look at and say they did not have a bona fide number one defenseman.
Drew Doughty, Duncan Keith. I mean, you look at the Cup winners of the 2010s; they were loaded.
Petrangelo, both for the Blues and for the Vegas
Golden Knights. It's a hard thing to come by, incredibly hard thing to come by. Generally, you have to draft them in the top 10, top 5, right? Or maybe you get lucky and you hit an Erik Karlsson in the teens of the draft, or you hit a Shea Weber in the second round. Like, it just, these guys, they are incredibly rare.
Like, Alex Edler may be the best third-round pick the Canucks have ever made.
Oh, like, I mean, to get a third-round pick that ends up playing 1,000 games in the league and is considered one of the top, like, what, even on a conservative level, at Edler's peak, he was thought of as a top 40, top 50 defenseman in the league.
Yeah, I mean, a top caliber defenseman, a guy drafted in the third round, and he made a meteoric rise to the National Hockey League, too. I mean, he went from being drafted in 2004 and playing in the 06-07 season in the NHL.
Yeah.
And he played playoff games that year.
Yeah.
And when he showed, I remember, like, when he made that jump, he went to Kelowna one year, and he looked great playing for the Kelowna Rockets in 05-06. And it's like, okay, well, he's going to try at the AHL level. And there was some question, should he go to the AHL? Should he maybe stay in junior an extra year, considering, you know, how little experience he has? Because he essentially was playing men's beer league hockey level. That's what he was playing until he ended up going to Moto and really taking that step to play against higher competition. He spends not even a full year in Manitoba, plays NHL games, and then next year he's pretty much a full-time top four, top five defenseman for the team. And from that point, he never looked back. Like, there are very few players drafted in the third round that take 2.5 years to become a big-time player for you, let alone a top four defenseman.
You know, it's one of those fun draft stories where you kind of, like, uncover a gem that nobody else really knows about. Like, wasn't it the Detroit Red Wings were the only other shocker. The Detroit Red Wings were the only other team sniffing around Alex Edler. I mean, he is, and because of the way his career ended, and, you know, the need for a rebuild that just wasn't really happening in Vancouver, and knowing Edler could fetch you any kind of future asset, and how people felt when he wouldn't waive his no move clause, you know, he earned that. He signed forwarded his contract. It's not up to him necessarily, but it just, it always felt like towards the end, how impactful, how valuable Edler was. It almost turned out that he ended up being underappreciated by the time his Canucks career came to an end.
Yeah, there was always a question of, can he be more? Should he be more?
Yeah.
That's how tantalizing it was, honestly. Like, the level of talent he had and what he could do, there was always an expectation he can be more and do more. And he had some tough moments. Like, he had moments where he lost his confidence. It looked bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he had a lot of, you know, issues on the ice when things weren't going well for him. And that, I think, soured a lot of people on him. But generally speaking, the guy was physical. He played at a top four level. And at his absolute peak, I'd say in the 2011 playoffs, he played as a number one defenseman. I think he hit that peak.
Yeah.
And it almost was enough to help the Canucks win. I know I've brought this up many times, and I'll bring it up with Yannick again too, but Game 5, 2011, against the Bruins, Alex Edler was the best player on the ice.
Yeah.
And those playoffs, there were games where he was an absolute force out there. And if he doesn't break a few fingers, who knows what happens in Game 6 and 7 if you have Edler at full butt, not to mention everybody else, right? But nonetheless, he played at that level. And that's one of the reasons why that 2011 team in the postseason was as good as it was.
Torgi, with this text, did you guys see the video the Canucks posted where Quinn acknowledged Edler as the Canucks GOAT? He's so classy. Love them both. Edler is underappreciated. Another one. Cop car builder Chris, do you think Patrick Alvin asked Edler if he was interested in one more crack at the can? I think if you saw some of the Canucks videos, Edler is full-time dad now. So I'm not sure that's in the cards at this moment. But I know the jokes have been going around about the Canucks third pair and maybe the struggles that they had in the first game. So let's get to the news of the day. It's the Canucks Central Roundup. And we'll start with the goaltending situation before we get back in on defense. And Kevin Lankinen is getting the start. For me, I've heard a couple of people phrase it, and maybe it's just the semantics and the crazy person in my head that's wanting to correct everybody on this. But I don't know. Like, if they win that game 4-2 the other night, do the Canucks still go to Kevin Lankinen here tonight against Philadelphia? It's very possible that this was always the plan. It just feels like because Shelov's had a tough night in game one, the Canucks are turning to Lankinen because of Shelov's poor performance in game one, when I think this was probably the plan all along.
I'm with you. I think it was. I mean, I even mentioned this before the game. We spoke about this in the preseason, that don't be surprised to see a split the first two games. You go on a road trip. Until you really get a good feel about where you are goaltending-wise, you probably want to alternate starts or give a guy a couple, give the other guy one or a couple. Like, you're going to see a pretty even split, and I think that was always in the plan until you maybe get a determination of who to lean on a bit more. And the first game for Shelov didn't go great.
Yeah.
I think the bigger thing today is if Lankinen plays well, does he get the next game? And if he plays well in the next game, do you give him a few games in a row? That's what I look at now after Shelov's first game. And not to put too much on the game. It's only one game. And, you know, we saw Kevin Woodley briefly today at the office. And, you know, he mentioned to us that, hey, yeah, he didn't have a good game. But some of the numbers in terms of, you know, the screens, like, there were high danger goals. Like you mentioned, 5 out of 6 goals were high danger by Clear Sight's analytics. So it's like, okay, so a lot of these were, you know, difficult. As much as he has trouble with screens, they're of the more difficult variety to save. But nonetheless, he still allowed more than he should have, but it was maybe not as bad as we made it out to be, or people feel, perhaps.
You can still, you know, just because it's a high danger chance doesn't mean you can't make the save.
Yeah, for sure. And that's not to excuse it, but it's just provide some context.
Yeah, and a lot of it to do with the screens that were in front of Shelov's. And this ties into the whole conversation about him, you know, still struggling with that part of his game and it being a very obvious thing that teams are honing in on, that it's part of their pre-scout, that they want to get this set up in front of Shelov's. They know he has trouble with it, getting that high layered screen and taking the shot from the point, trying to pick a corner on him as he tries to search for the puck. And so you think about that, and you look at Lankinen, and you look at this spot, it feels like a big spot for Lankinen here tonight. Not to put a a ton of pressure on it. It is still
it's game two, Dan. What are you trying to do?
It is game two of the season, but you know, seasons can spiral out of control.
It's only one. Don't talk about spiraling two games in, Dan. Come on.
Well, it didn't seem all that bad a couple of years ago with Bruce Boudreau.
Oh, come on.
They've blown third period multi-goal leads in multiple games back-to-back-to-back.
Are we invoking Bruce here after a loss?
I'm not invoking this. All I'm saying, things can escalate quickly.
Yeah,
I'm quoting Ron Burgundy on this. It could escalate quickly. And real okay, kidding aside, it does feel like a big spot for Lankinen.
Yeah.
He signs a bargain deal, 1 year deal. The young guy, the incumbent, has a tough game in game one. You go into game two, you have a good game. Maybe you get game three.
Yeah.
Right? And this is where the competition of it starts to build between Lankinen and Shelov.
Yeah, and I think if he plays really well, do you give him a little bit of a run? Now, I do think they want to get Shelov back in again. They want to get both guys established. Like, I think the plan had been early on to get both guys into a lot. But, yeah, if he plays really well, does he get the next one? And then you go from there. The Canucks don't have a back-to-back for a while anyways.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I do think you still want to get off to a good start this season. And to your point, is it a big spot in terms of early in the season? Yeah. Could this give Lankinen the slight edge early on with a good start to maybe command the net a bit here for the team?
So it is Kevin Lankinen making his Canucks debut tonight for the Vancouver Canucks here against the Philadelphia Flyers. Pew Suter returns into the lineup. Nils Åman is coming out of the forward group. I know we talked a little bit about it in our conversations about the game off the air, but you know, Nils Åman isn't a guy that tends to move the needle with listeners all that much. He's kind of just one of the last guys on the roster. You expect him to be kind of reliable, not do too much offensively, but you don't expect him to give up too much defensively either when he's on the ice. But you go back and rewatch some of the goals, you could see Nils Åman having a little bit of trouble on some of the goals against the other night, and that's part of the reason he's coming out tonight.
Yeah, for sure. And I think having Suter back is a positive. I think he'll help on the PK as well. And now, as far as Ratu is concerned, he's going to play the wing initially.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a bit more, you know, I wouldn't say pressure necessarily, but there's more expectation that Ratu has to perform at that level because there is now a natural replacement on the roster that's healthy that can play in that spot. So I'm interested to see how Suter looks, but also how does Ratu look, and do you keep Suter on the wing the entirety of the game?
We talked about Daniel Sprong yesterday getting right in the pine for a little bit in that game the other night. So did Atu Ratu, but to his credit, was 5-1 in the draw. So one of the things that he needs to do to stay on this roster, win faceoffs, he was able to do that in game one. Noah Juulsen is coming in for Vincent Desharnais. And, I mean, it seems quick. This guy just signed a 2-year, $4 million deal with the Canucks. I know that they've sort of hammered it home that he is a guy they think highly of, and they really want to work with him to continue developing his game, but has a tough night, and he's coming out for Noah Juulsen.
Desharnais obviously wasn't great the first night.
Yeah.
Do I think he's being punished? I'm not sure about that necessarily. Much like the goaltending, I wouldn't be surprised if they wanted to get Juulsen in pretty early in the season too.
Right.
And we saw towards the end of last year, and even when the team started getting healthy, because they leaned on Juulsen quite a bit when they had a few injuries with Soucy especially.
They would get Juulsen in for Zadorov. Or...
Yeah, and they started rotating him in and started doing, you know, game management for guys. I think even Myers had a night. And
Cole had a night.
And, you know, they didn't love it, but even Zadorov did. Like, they tried to rotate him in as much as possible. They wanted to get him involved. It's early in the season. I think a lot of this is also they want to get him involved. And I think with Desharnais, it's clear Desharnais has never been more than a 6-7 defenseman. Like, even with Edmonton, as good as he was at times penalty killing in the playoffs, he didn't play every game in the playoffs. He didn't play every regular season game for them.
Yeah.
He's going to be a guy who has, to this point of his career, occasionally been healthy scratched, right? The hope in Vancouver had been, like he told us, that he's going to find another level, more consistency, and get a bit better here. He cited Myers to us that what was Myers in game one compared to what he was in game 82 in the postseason. He feels like with this coaching staff, he can learn. So I look at him as being a longer-term project in 2-year deal to see what he looks like. Can he be a bit more reliable? But I was never expecting him to come in right away and show that he's worth the contract they gave him. It was always going to be a bit of a project. And I'm not reading too much into it now. It's only game one. And I think a large part of it is trying to get Juulsen in.
I didn't actually mind his game in the playoffs against the Canucks too much. I thought he played pretty well against the Canucks, to be quite honest. In the third round, they brought Broberg in, and Broberg played so well that Desharnais was just, you know, not of use anymore, right? I think he only played one Stanley Cup final game for the Oilers after Broberg really found his stride and became a big part of that defense. The other part of this, so I think whenever a right-shot defenseman, 25 years old with a decent NHL track record to this point, Timothy Liljegren, is out there on the trade market, yeah, at a $3 million cap charge, so it's not cheap on the salary cap. But anytime that happens, every team in the league is sitting there and wondering, like, is this a guy we want to go after? Is this a right shot defenseman that we see potential in? Mm-hmm. Because players like this, first round pick, not all that long ago. I guess it was fairly long ago now because he's 25 years old. But Timothy Liljegren, like, an interesting player to me, Sat, that is out there on the market. And, you know, I feel the Canucks are forever in search of another top four defenseman.
I'm not sure if he's the fit the Canucks are looking for, but it's also an opportunity because, as you mentioned, 25 years old. He's 6'1", over 200 pounds.
Yep.
And if you want to look at, draw some parallels to other defensemen who improved in that age 24, 25, 26 range and kind of found another level, Gustav Forsling,
yeah,
there's similarities. Even a guy, his name just escapes me now all of a sudden. But there's a couple of guys. Maybe he'll come back to me here in a second. But there's a couple of guys that have emerged. Devon Taves, who's similar,
right,
thing. Guys who emerged a bit later, who showed some promise, but also in big spots did not look like they could handle it. But they developed into it.
Yeah.
And once they developed into it, you're talking about home run players. You got them for next to nothing. Forsling, you could pick up off the waiver wire. Got him for nothing, right? Taves, 2 second-round picks. But what's that for a legitimate top-pairing defenseman?
Yeah.
It's nothing, you know, at the end of the day. And Liljegren's going to be at a cut-rate price. If you believe in that opportunity and that potential, and you can get that answered for you now, there is intrigue in it. I'm unconvinced the Canucks are going to pull the trigger on it because I think it eats up your flexibility, even though the price of acquisition is not going to be a lot. If they could retain salary on it, I'm more interested into it, and I think that could make the Canucks a bigger player in it. But it is an opportunity. And if you're looking at finding a player that you could hit a home run on, that you're taking a gamble on for a cheap price, like, he's the type of guy that could develop into something.
You know, when we talked about Jake DeBrusk in the summer, I mentioned, you know, the Canucks don't have a ton of, like, trade assets. They don't have a ton of prospects to move in order to acquire players to fit into the top of your roster, so you've got to make bets somewhere. And they made the big bet with DeBrusk. They've made bets with Dakota Joshua, smaller bets that have hit big, that help and really add impact players to this roster. So you're going to have to do this in trade. And you don't have the big piece necessarily to go out and acquire. Like, look at what it costs to get Filip Hronek. Right?
Yeah.
Like, do you have the assets to make that move again? Sure, you have another first-round pick. Maybe.
Well, they have the assets. It's just, are you ready to make that move?
Right. And who is that player? Is that player even available, right? They don't often become available. When a guy – Liljegren is not a perfect player. He's got good stats in the regular season, untrustable in the playoffs. So there's definitely warts there. It's definitely a bit of a project. Can this coaching staff get him to be more physical and play to his you know, he's not the hugest guy, but he has enough size that he can play more physical than he has shown to be in the playoffs to this point of his career. But it is part and parcel a development project that you're going out and having to pay for and having to put onto your roster at a pretty expensive cost if it is the full $3 million. So that's where it does get dicey. But my point on this is you've got to take bets somewhere, and this organization, this front office, hasn't been afraid to make bets if they feel the player and the player profile, it fits what they want to do.
And they jumped an opportunity last year, which was Zadorov. And with Zadorov, they made a projection, too, on him. They thought, okay, he's a guy that has been a third-pair guy, but we think he can do more for us. Now, in the regular season, he didn't play a feature role, but you saw what happened in the postseason. Liljegren does not have the same profile. I don't think he hasn't shown he can be a playoff impact player. But it was still a player who they took a bet on at a cheap price, who was in a tenuous situation with his club. Liljegren, cheap price, tenuous position with his club. How much is this team looking for the perfect fit or also looking to exploit an opportunity? Because this is an opportunity. It's just how much do you believe in executing on it? Again, I'm unconvinced the Canucks pull the trigger on this.
Yeah.
But I would be shocked if they haven't seriously considered it at the very least or even have had some sort of discussions about it.
It's Dan Riccio, Sat TR Shaw. Keep those texts coming in, 650, 650 on the Dunbar Lumber text message inbox. It's Dan Riccio and Sat TR Shaw. The Roar is back at BC Place for the BC Lions 70th season. Get your tickets now at bclions.com. Yannick Hansen will join us next. His take on Alex Edler and what he saw in game one of the season from the Vancouver Canucks. That's next on Sportsnet 650.